Welcome, everybody. This is the first office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Introduction to the Free Market. And for those who are new to these types of classes, in these office hours sessions, it's a free-for-all where I just field any questions that people may ask me. So for those of you who are tuned in live here, in case you're new, let me just make sure you know the format. Just go ahead and type your questions right in. It can be right in the main chat window because there's not as many people, so it's fine. It won't get knocked off the screen. And also, if somebody posts a question and I'm answering it, and then you have your question, go ahead and type it in. You don't have to wait for me to finish because it helps me pace myself to see what questions you guys have up there. So go ahead and fire away, guys. That's the way this will work. As always with these kind of things, it's better for you to type something, even if you think it's not great, than nothing. And remember, it can be about anything. It doesn't have to be pertaining to this course or let alone this week's material. Let me, for you guys who are logged in here, as I say, go ahead and throw up something. All right, there you go. Great. And then I do have something else I can talk about if you guys are hurting for ideas. And I know sometimes people log in just to see what other people ask. Okay, Andrew says, how do mainstream economists explain the origins of money? That's a great question. I'm not sure because that's not something that I ever went over with them at NYU when I was, my idea of what mainstream economists think comes from my experience in grad school. Because when I went an undergrad, I was at Hillsdale College. I went there specifically to study Austrian economics. So that wasn't really an unbiased sampling of the profession, the professors that teach at Hillsdale. And then once I graduated, I went and taught at Hillsdale, and then since then I've just been basically operating within Austrian circles. So my real exposure to what the mainstream was the time at grad school, and then when I was on the conventional job market right when I was leaving grad school. So anyway, to answer your question, my guess is they didn't that they don't think about it very much. I think the average mainstream economist is just into whatever he or she does in terms of the specialty, and that questions like where did money come from is not something they would have studied much. In other words, you can go and get a PhD in economics without ever having studied something like, now, this week in class, we're going to learn the origin of money. It's not like there's such a discussion in a typical curriculum. But believe it or not, Carl Menger's explanation for the origin of money, it's not that Austrians focus on his explanation just because, he's the founder of the Austrian school and so we like him, and that we ignore the more standard mainstream. Actually, a lot of Menger's explanation is, or at least was, part of the mainstream explanation. And in fact, He didn't just invent that out of whole cloth. That even in Adam Smith and in some other classical works, there is a discussion of where money came from. It's not as refined because theoretically Adam Smith didn't have a subjective theory of value to work with. So obviously he couldn't give the exact same explanation for the origin of money that Menger gave, because Adam Smith was working with what we now consider to be an obsolete value theory, and having modern marginal utility theory is part of how Menger's explanation even works. But even Adam Smith talked about the disadvantages of barter or what we would call direct exchange, and then explained how people might have gradually seized upon a few goods, commodities, to be money. So all that to say that Menger, for at least for a while, had written the definitive explanation, and I'm almost positive that in an Encyclopedia of Economics, the chapter or the topic or the entry on the origin of money was written by Karl Menger. Okay, so it's, I might be getting the details a little bit fuzzy there, but I know that Menger was, at one point at least, you know, had written the definitive explanation of that branch of economics. There's other people who, or there's other theories, and now they're coming more into vogue. And you might call it the state theory of money, and I believe it was associated with this guy called Knapp, which is spelled K-N-A-P-P. And with these guys, like modern monetary theorists of the MMT crowd, they're big into this explanation now. And then when you hear Paul Krugman and other people talking about fiat money versus Bitcoin, things like that, they also make some of these points, so it wouldn't surprise me if they subscribe to this view as well. So this rival theory is to say that money was created by some sort of political authority, and that specifically the way you get a group of people to start using something as money is to insist that the taxes be paid in that thing. And so that's how, you know, and so I haven't researched it carefully, but apparently there are historical examples of like the British Empire conquering some place somewhere and then wanting to get the people there to use something as money. And so they say they, you know, levy some sort of tax and tell the population you need to pay the tax in this particular item. And so that forces everybody in the community to come up with that thing to be able to pay the, you know, occupying British forces. So, and so back to what I was saying with Krugman, he recently was being interviewed by Joe Weisenthal of Business Insider, and Weisenthal was asking him about Bitcoin and do you think it's a bubble, and Krugman said, yeah, because it has no intrinsic value. You know, there's, in other words, there's nothing that Bitcoin is good for except for the fact that right now it has purchasing power. And so it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy that people accept Bitcoin because people accept Bitcoin. And, you know, there's no reason to explain where did its value come from other than just, it just, it seems like we're in this weird equilibrium that just came out of nowhere. And it's, and there's nothing propping it up. So what's funny is you could understand why an Austrian might say that, like somebody who thinks gold and silver should be money. But it's odd to hear Krugman talking like that because Krugman, of course, is a big fan of government fiat money. And so Weisenthal then was quick to let Krugman clarify, because heaven forbid, you know, somebody cast aspersions on fiat money. And so Weisenthal said, but actually that's, you know, that's not the case for government fiat money, right? And Krugman said, no, because you're right, Joe, because fiat money is backed up by men with guns. And in case you think I'm exaggerating, Krugman literally said that. He literally said fiat money is backed up by men with guns. And he wasn't saying it like, and that's why it's a horrible thing. He was just saying it matter-of-factly with a smirk in his face. So so there, what he was trying to say is the reason that he, Paul Krugman, thought Bitcoin was going to crash was that there's, you know, ultimately no, there's no fundamental value for it, right? Whether it's $1,000 per Bitcoin or 2 pennies or $10 million, there's no rational reason for it to be any of the other of them. And so, you know, it could collapse tomorrow. Whereas he's saying U.S. dollar bills and euros and Japanese yen, they have value in the sense that their governments will throw you in jail unless you hand over enough of those units every year to the tax authority. And so that's what's going to force people to sell their labor hours or to do whatever in order to acquire those things. Okay, so that's the, those are the two main types of explanations for the origin of money. On the one hand, you've got the Mengerian explanation, and again, it's not that Karl Menger invented this from scratch and nobody before him had an inkling of it, but he gave the most eloquent and logically cohesive explanation to say that no, there was no genius or there was no group of people with force to cause a community consciously to start using something as money. That we can explain the origin of money as a spontaneous, decentralized thing that sort of just happened naturally with each person acting in his or her own immediate self-interest. And then, even though nobody intended it, you look around and, oh my gosh, all of a sudden we're using a medium of exchange and the whole community is accepting it, and that's money. And look at all the benefits of engaging in transactions using money versus using direct exchange. So that's one type of explanation, whereas the other qualitatively different type of explanation says there must have been some group or some individual who consciously decided, I think the community ought to be using this thing as money, and we're going to take steps to make that happen. So, Andrew, back to your question, how do mainstream economists explain the origins of money? I think, like I say, the main answer, my main answer to that is, I think most of them probably don't even have an explanation. They just never even thought about it, or if they did, it's not like they went and researched it. And then to the extent that they do have a theory, I think it would be one of those two approaches. That, and also, my guess is, too, that the knee-jerk reaction would be the state theory of money. That even a lot of mainstream economists, even though you might think otherwise, they do not, their default for something is still to think that, oh, the government should be in charge of that, or, you know, any kind of social issue, even trained economists, let alone the general public, just the default is the government must have been involved or the government should be involved to fix this, as opposed to a more organic explanation and how could this thing have arisen through voluntary processes. But, as I say, plenty of mainstream economists are familiar with the Mengerian approach. In fact, I did, when I was at NYU, we had to do what was called a third-year paper. And the point of that was to get you to know how to write an academic economics paper for a journal. So that was the function of the class was not to teach you any particular content. The class was, in this class, you're going to pick a topic and you're going to write a paper, because the function of the class was, how do you do that? How do you be a researcher in professional academic economics? And so I was trying to find a topic that nobody had talked about. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to formalize Menger's explanation of the origin of money. So in other words, I'll take Menger's logic and, you know, the verbal story he gave, and I'll dress it up with mathematical symbols and things, and you know, make it rigorous the way that a modern mainstream journal would want, because I thought surely nobody else has done that, because these mainstream guys don't even know who Menger is, right? But that was my thinking. And so I do that, you know, I dress it all up, and I had some cute little math stuff going on. I was kind of proud of it, and I presented it at the paper at NYU, the seminar at NYU, and one of the old school guys there, who, you know, he was not an Austrian, but he was kind of eclectic, and he just knew a bunch of stuff, and he was widely read, and he said, oh, Kiatokian, right, they did exactly that back in 94, exactly. I'm making up the year, I don't remember what the year was, and I was like, what? And I went and looked, and he was right. These two guys, years earlier, had done just that. They had taken Karl Menger's explanation for the origin of money and made it mathematical, and da-da-da. So they had a cute little mainstream model to try to explain the origin of money that way. And so I was surprised, both pleasantly and unpleasantly, that I was pleasantly surprised that, oh, a lot of, you know, mainstream economists who aren't Austrians who are appreciating the work of Karl Menger. But then, of course, I was mad that, geez, I just wasted all the time doing this paper and somebody already beat me to the punch a decade ago. Okay, Steven says or asks, would the Hudson Bay fur traders in Oregon before statehood be an example of a society with indirect trade but not money? Then he goes on, I was a little confused looking for an example. The Hudson Bay Company traded for money elsewhere, but it seemed like fur and other commodities were more in demand as mediums in the immediate area. Okay, just one clarification. The plural for medium is media, right? Just like you talk about the mainstream media. It's the same thing here. Okay, I don't know that much. I mean, I've heard of the Hudson Bay fur traders and art, but I mean, I don't know beyond what I may have remembered from hearing in fifth grade or something. So I have that handicap going on here. But let me just say some general things, Stephen. We almost can't have a record of a group of people without money. And it's funny, this guy Graeber, Graeber, let me see if I can, he had this book called Debt, The First 5,000 Years. Let's see, is it David Green? Yeah. Yeah, it's David Graeber. And again, it's Graeber, Debt. And if you do Murphy Review Origin, let's see if that pops up. Yeah. So for the magazine or the website, The American Conservative, I wrote a review of this guy's book. And they gave it a clever title. The title of the review, they named it Origin of the Species. So like the word species, but just take the last S off. And so they're doing a play on word there. So it sounds like I'm talking about Darwin, you know, Origin of the Species. But they took the S off, so it's Origin of the Species, because that's a word meaning like hard money, species is. And so it's because Graeber and I are battling over the origin of money. So anyway, if you're interested in this stuff, I'll post the link here in the chat box, but if you're just hearing this online later, you can find it easily. If you Google Robert Murphy, Origin of the Species, David Graeber, you should be able to get it. But here, I'll post this in the chat box for you guys if you want to look at it later. But in there, the reason that your question, Stephen, sparked that thought is, so this guy Graeber goes through and he systematically, in his mind, demolishes the Mengerian explanation for the origin of money. And so if you're curious, you know, you go to that argument and I provide a summary of it, and then I explain the ways that David Graeber thinks this story isn't true. And one of his arguments is to say something like, you know, we have no historical or archaeological evidence of the Mengerian story, right? So it's just like his point, Graeber's point is, people like Adam Smith and Carl Menger just dreamed this story up because it fits their preconceived notions, and you know, it fits their political ideology, because it looks like it's showing you could just have markets and you don't need government to do stuff. You know, you don't need governments to build roads, you don't need governments to make money. And Graeber is right that there is that ideological slant to it. I mean, when I teach this stuff, I will often comment upon it and say, you know, it didn't take a state or a king to make money. The market did it. And so, you know, why do I say that? Well, it's admittedly partly because I want to get people to realize that the power of free societies and that you don't need government to solve problems or to make life better. So that's true. It does fit in with that narrative. But so one of Graeber's points in his mind, he thought it was a crushing argument, was to say, you know, point out a society to me where this has happened. And that was, and so Stephen, this is where I'm going with this. If you're curious, what does this have to do with your question about the Hudson Bay fur traders? Is that because you're saying you were looking for an example? The point is, there is no example. And that was what Graeber was saying. He said, I'm looking around, show me a society where people are just engaged in direct exchange, the way Menger and Adam Smith says was like, you know, the original scenario. And then people realized, oh, this isn't working very well. There's limitations to direct exchange. So now we need to have indirect exchange. So let me accept this thing as a medium of exchange. And Graeber is saying, you know, show me the money, show me the lack of money. He's saying, show me where is there society? And he's saying, even, you know, when missionaries or other types of explorers would stumble upon some, you know, primitive tribe somewhere uncontaminated with access to the outside world, they would all have money as well, right? So it's saying we can't find any society anywhere where people are doing the kind of thing that Menger says they must have been doing before his story kicked in. And so what I argued, I don't know if it's in this piece or if I did it elsewhere, because I wrote several venues responding to Graeber's arguments, but one of my responses to that was to say, well, that would have been a very fleeting situation, right? It's not that Menger was saying, or that Mises was saying, there'd be a society using direct exchange for 300 years, and then in year 301, finally, somebody would get the bright idea to accept a medium of exchange. That, no, I mean, it could happen very quickly, but logically, you would first need to have direct exchange before you could possibly say, oh, wait a minute, let me accept this thing in trade because I know this guy over here accepts it in trade. How could you even know that unless you first observe direct exchange? That's the idea. So, you would have to have direct exchange first, because indirect exchange is like a corollary or an extension of it. But the point is, it's so natural and advantageous to engage in indirect exchange that you wouldn't have this stationary society just doing direct exchange year after year. And also, if you did, it would be a very primitive society. Right? They'd be very poor. And so you wouldn't have records. You know what I mean? So it's like Graeber's kind of saying, show me the stone tablets showing the accounting done in days when there was direct exchange, but well, by definition, they couldn't, well, not by definition, but by implication, they couldn't have had accounting if they just used direct exchange. That's part of the point. It's one of the limitations of it. That's one of the benefits of money. And they probably wouldn't even have had a division of labor in any meaningful sense if they still had just direct exchange. So that's kind of the issue, that you wouldn't expect to find records or evidence, you know, archaeological digs and stuff of a society that just had direct exchange, because they wouldn't have been a civilization. They wouldn't have been able to do that. There wouldn't have been anybody able to build a house and sell it to somebody if you just used direct exchange. Okay, so having said all that, then, Stephen, it is still true. So you could have different groups, though, that used money internally, and then when these groups occasionally interacted with each other, then they would engage in what to us we would call barter, because they didn't recognize each other's monies. You see how that works? So just like you can imagine aliens, very, you know, have a very sophisticated civilization, they have, you know, all kinds of scientific discoveries, a high standard of living, they build spacecraft. And they come to see us, well, if the logical structure of their mind is like ours in any way, they're going to need money to be able to do all that stuff. Okay? So they have their money and we have our money here on Earth, but if they show up tomorrow and want to trade with us, probably initially it's going to be direct exchanges, that they're going to, you know, give us whatever, super laser guns, and we're going to give them oil, or so who knows what. But they would be direct exchanges at first, because we wouldn't have any familiarity with their media of exchange are, what the price ratios are, things like that. And the same with them with us. So same thing here, that when like a fur trader, I mean, they would have had, or the people who lived in the Hudson Bay area, settlers and stuff, obviously they would have had money. they would have come from what we would call civilized areas, and then the groups that they interacted with also would have had some type of money. You know, it might have been different. And so, yeah, when they encountered each other, they would engage in one-off trades. But, I mean, particularly if you weren't sure when you were going to see those people again. You see why, you know, it would have to be a direct exchange because, you know, the point of doing indirect exchange is that you're going to come back to the market in the future. Or that you have some other person in mind. You're gonna, you know, so if you're just talking about one-off, you bump into some people, they have what you want, you have what they want, and you make a trade, you know, that's why it's got to be a direct exchange in that kind of a setting. Whereas indirect exchange means you actually don't want the thing that they have, but you realize somebody else will down the road. And so that kind of interaction requires repetition in a recurring market. Okay, Stephen says, so to describe a society that uses indirect exchange but has not developed money, do you mean just imagine what that would be like if there is no actual historical example? Oh, okay, yeah, sorry, I didn't realize you were, okay, sorry about that. Yeah, now I see. When you said you were looking for an example, you meant because that's what the textbook asked you to do. Sorry, I didn't realize that's why you're doing that. You're just curious on your own and we're thinking about it. Correct. So, well, it's a little bit subtle. So don't misunderstand me. When I say there's no historical example of a society that just had direct exchange, I'm not saying that it never existed. I'm just saying it would have existed so briefly that they wouldn't have left the historical record. You get what I'm saying? So, I mean, you know, there could be some homeless guy who spends 30 years living in a town and a few people know him, and then he dies and you know, they don't bury him. They don't even know where his body is. And someone might say of that guy, there's no historical record of that guy, of that hobo gin that lived under the bridge. But the people who knew him would know, no, he really did exist. There's just no historical record of him. That's the sense in which I'm saying this, that logically speaking, there must have been first people who were just engaged in direct exchange. And then, logically speaking, before they could be using money, somebody must have accepted something as a medium of exchange. And so, boom, right then, now we have indirect exchange. They've moved beyond direct exchange. Now they're doing indirect exchange in this group of people. But that thing can't be money right off the bat, because to be money, it has to be a medium of exchange that's widely accepted or commonly accepted. And so, again, logically speaking, the progression must have been direct exchange, then indirect exchange, and then finally money. So, yeah, Stephen, to answer your question here, I meant just think through what would that look like, or what would make some true statements about that kind of a situation. And so, it's true to say there's no historical example, right? You're not going to be able to think and say, oh, it's like, you know, the stormtroopers on the Endor moon. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying you think of what it would be like. So yes, there must have been a group like that existed, but it's not like you would have learned about them, because for you to have learned about some group of people, they would have needed money in order to make enough of an impact to get into the history books. Let me just say one more. We got some other questions here, and thank you guys for posting these so we can just keep moving through this. But let me just say one other thing. Part of the reason I go through this stuff so methodically and painstakingly is that, you want this phone, buddy? Okay, so hang on 1 second. Let me just give my son my phone so he's not bored out of his mind here. Is that this term barter, that a lot of people think there's either money or not, and that's it. And so that's why I'm trying to, with that question, Steve, and that's the function of that, is I want to get you to see the Austrian definitions and categories that you could have direct exchange, which of course doesn't involve money. And you can also have, and then of course you can have money, but then there's this intermediate stage where there's indirect exchange, but it's not yet money. And so most people, even many economists, would never have thought of such an intermediate scenario. And so that's why I want you to think through that, because the function of that question, what I want you to get out of it, is to really understand what do we mean by direct versus indirect exchange, and then what does it mean for something to be money. And so if you think of that intermediate knife edge case, I think that'll clarify those concepts for you. That's the educational purpose of that question in there. I really want to drive home those concepts. Because for a lot of people, they think, and that's what this word barter, what does barter mean? For a lot of people, they would just say, oh, it means, you know, people who don't use money. But I think they believe it means you directly want what you're getting. So that's really what we would call direct exchange. And so I think a lot of people, you know, wouldn't even have the vocabulary to express a situation where there's indirect exchange, but it's not money. They would just say, you know, no, it's money if you get it and you don't, you know, if you're going to use it to give away something else, then that's what money is. Or barter just means you want to use it directly and you're not using money. And so you see how that's actually kind of fuzzy. Okay, Kay says or asks, hi Bob, BBC replayed Nassim Taleb's Black Swan Sorbonne talk this morning. Why, oh why, did not one person in the audience point out the important points come from Mises and are not a new insight de novo without the Austrian foundation? Well, yeah, I mean, I understand your frustration. So I haven't seen his particular talk. I mean, I've read his book. I'm familiar with his work. So for people who don't know, this guy, Taleb, had a best-selling book called The Black Swan, I don't know, like 8 years ago, something like that. I mean, if you know, okay, you can say it and I'll repeat it. But so he was working in the financial sector as an investor. And then what he and his partner would do, my understanding is, I'm obviously going to dumb it down a little bit, but I think this is correct. They would put options that were out of the money, deeply out of the money. Okay, so what a put option does is it allows you to sell something at a guaranteed price. So if you own some stocks, let's say you own a stock that right now is trading for $100 a share. You can buy a put option on that stock. And what the option allows you to do, let's say the particular option you buy says, this option will give me the ability to sell that stock at $50 a share. Okay, so you wouldn't use it right now while the stock actually isn't trading at 100. You would just not use that option. You would have bought the option and then not use it. You know, so you would have wasted money on that option. But if all of a sudden the stock collapses down to 40, so that's, you know, normal people buying and selling that stock in the market, get it at a price of 40, now your put option is valuable, because that put option says, basically the person who sold you the put option is agreeing that person will buy the stock from you at 50. That's what you bought from the person is an agreement, a contract saying, if I decide I want to do it, this person has to buy the stock from me at $50 a share. So again, you would never do that if the real price is above 50, because you would just sell it in the market and earn more than 50. But if the actual spot price drops below 50, then you would exercise the option. Okay, so, and in that case, like I say, if the actual price happened to drop to 40, now your option would itself be worth $10. You see how that works? Because it's allowing you to sell the stock for 50 when everybody else is only paying 40 for it. So another way of seeing it is you could take 40 yourself, buy a share of it at 40, and then use the put option to sell it to this guy for 50, so you've made 10. So that's, you know, the put option is now giving you $10 of extra value there. So that's why the put option itself will have a value of 10. Okay, so what these guys did is they got a sense that the market was overvalued. You know, this is right before the 2008 crash. You know, they, through various means, they knew that this is not normal, this is not a healthy economy, and that things are much riskier right now than the market prices are reflecting. And so one of the ways they profited from that, or they positioned themselves, is they bought a lot of put options that were deeply out of the money, meaning they were locking in the ability to sell it well below what the current prices were. And so they could get them very cheaply because it didn't look like those things have it, right? So the thing right now is selling for 100 and you buy a put option to sell it, that gives you the right to sell at 50. The person issuing that option to you thinks that's never going to come back to bite me because right now it's trading at 100. It would have to fall in half for this thing to even be, you know, so they would sell me the option and not charge me very much for it. You see, so if someone's going to issue an option that might come back and be used against them, they're going to need to, you're going to have to pay them for that, right? They're not just going to do that for free and put themselves on the line for no reward. Okay, so the point is these guys, Taleb and his partners, they spend a bunch of money buying very cheaply all these things that were, if the market crashed, now all of a sudden these things would have a lot of value. Okay, so if you, going back to the example, if you just had to pay $1 for that put option, and then the stock drops to 40, so now that put is worth 10, well, it just went up by a factor of 10, right? You put in $1 by the put option, and now the put option is worth 10. So what you paid $1 for is now worth 10. So that's a huge increase, right? So, so you see how that, you would have made more doing that than if you just bought all, if you just shorted the stocks. Because if you just shorted the stocks and they went from 100 down to 40, like it depends how leveraged you were. So let's not even go down that path. Okay, but anyway, that was a way you could magnify your investment very quickly if you were right. So that's the kind of stuff they did. And his philosophical outlook in many ways is compatible with Austrian economics. That in particular, Taleb was very dismissive of the mainstream mathematical economists who thought they had neat and tidy little models of the stock market with, you know, efficient markets and all that stuff. And Taleb was saying, no, these guys are chumps. You know, they're not even good mathematicians. Like, actual mathematicians know that this dabbling that these economists do in the financial markets is goofy. You know, and they're like using like bell curve distributions. I'm not using the technical words because I don't know how much math you guys know. But the point is, these economists would come along and study the stock market and throw out some stuff, but it wasn't actually very sophisticated and rigorous. And so that's partly where Taleb and the people thinking like him came in, as they realized that, oh, there's this wide open opportunity here. And the fundamental thing that Taleb put his finger on was to say, these guys are overconfident, that they think they understand how the market works and they are wrong. That, so it's not that Taleb was saying, I know it's going to crash in 2008 in the fall. It's not that he was saying that. It's just he knew in 2007 when everybody was like, oh, yeah, this is great, things are going. He knew that, no, you cannot be this confident that prosperity is here and that the market really ought to be priced like this. So that was more of his angle. And so it's interesting, Kay. So let me just make two points and I'll move on here. So in case you guys don't know, what Kay's frustration is saying that if you listen to these interviews, like a lot of regular financial sector people now think Taleb is, you know, he's this guru. Like, they think he's a genius, and like he says things that have this real deep meaning. And, oh, and the issue with the black swan was just to say, you know, normally swans are white. And so you might empirically conclude, oh, all swans are white, but then when you see a black swan, you realize you were wrong, and it blows up your world. All right. Or another example that they used is the turkey that's being fattened before Thanksgiving dinner, if you just used empiricism as your guide, the turkeys, you know, as they were talking to each other, get fatter and fatter as the weeks went on, would think that, no, life is good. You know, the farmers really love us and take care of us. Look at, they feed us and And then, of course, that would all change when time for to prepare the Thanksgiving meal, and that same farmer came and chopped your head off or whatever they do to it. You can tell I didn't grow up on a farm. Okay? So that's, you know, he would use examples like that to try to show the absurdity. You know, that's like saying, well, housing prices across the country haven't fallen uniformly in forever, or at least since the Great Depression, and so that's why we can give these mortgage-backed securities AAA ratings, blah, blah, blah. So it's that kind of intellectual hubris that Taleb was really hammering against. So there is a lot of overlap with the Austrian critique of mathematical economics. Mises and others stress that, you know, you can't mathematically model human action the way that these mainstream people try to do, or mainstream economists try to do. So there's a lot of overlap. But just so you know, Kay, I mean, Taleb was very sympathetic to Austrian stuff, and I sent him some of my, I co-authored a paper with this guy when I was at Hillsdale. But it's not worth getting into. I mean, if somebody wants to send me an email, I can send you a copy of it. It's not worth me talking about right now, but it was sort of like taking the mathematical economists on their own terms and showing them with better math that, no, what you guys are doing is not good statistically. And so Taleb liked that. And then we were trying to put an Austrian spin on it. And he sent me like his next book, and in the inscription, he said something like for liberty or Taleb, you know, Nassim Taleb or something. So he, in other words, Kay, it's not just that he's a finance guy and saw some holes in the way these guys thought and was poking holes in it and made a bunch of money. Like he, in his mind, he's fighting for human liberty too, so he's kind of a cool guy, and he is very respectful of Hayek in particular. And also, I don't know if you've seen it, and not in the Black Swan, I don't think. I think it's in his follow-up book, and that's why I had the audacity to reach out and start sending him stuff, because he just tears Paul Samuelson a new one. And so Paul Samuelson was a huge gun in Keynesian mathematical economics. In fact, arguably the single person most responsible for mathematizing and making modern formal economics look like old classical physics is Paul Samuelson doing. So anyway, Taleb was just, you know, excoriating Samuelson in one of his things. And so that's why I thought, you know, this is my kind of guy. The other thing is, Kay, Taleb's old partner has come out, Mark Spitznagel has come out with a book called, let me just see what the subtitle is, The Tao of Capital, Austrian Investing in a Distorted World. And so Spitznagel worked with Taleb when the, you know, in the fund that they had. And but Spitznagel is explicitly Austrian, and I helped him with that book. He was, you know, he retained me as a consultant for the book I just told you about, The Tao of Capital, and that's spelled DAO. And, you know, so he would send me certain chapter drafts where he's talking about Bob or some other Austrian guys to see if I thought he was on the right track. And, what Spitznagel does in there is he says, just what you're saying here, Kay, that, you know, yeah, when I used to invest with Taleb, we, you know, made a bunch of money and stuff, but he said it's actually, these were not black swans. Because in Taleb's world, it's very random, right? So it's not that Taleb said, I knew a crash was coming. It's rather he said, I could tell we were vulnerable to a crash, and that the risks, the credit spread, and, you know, other measures of risk in the market prices did not adequately reflect how precarious the market was back in 2007. But it's not that he had some theory telling him a crash is coming. And Spitznagel, though, in this book, The Tao of Capital, says, yes, we do have a theory. It's called Austrian Business Cycle Theory. And that once you understand that, and then, you know, he tries to make it operational from an investment perspective. You know, he says that it wasn't that the crash, you know, the financial panic of 2008 was just this random thing that's going to hit every 50 years. That no, you Austrian theory would have shown us it was coming. And so that's his take, to say these are not random things. And so they're not black swans in the connotation of what that term's come to give to people. Okay. So anyway, Kay, if you got frustrated by that, you might want to check out Spitznagel's book. You know, the next time you're in Barnes & Noble, just go grab it off the shelf and flip through it and see if it's something you might want to get. Okay, Jed Martin says, is there any relationship between the word capital is used to describe one of the three factors of production and when used to describe money itself? Okay, great question, Jed. And there's various depths of answer I could give you. Just so you guys know, when my PhD dissertation was in what would be called capital and interest theory. And I was warned when I started going down that path, somebody told me, they said, Bob, you know that that's the black hole of economics. And that's a phrase that's been bandied about. So this can get really dicey really fast. So let me just say a few things, Jed, that we're on fairly safe ground. The Austrians, I think, are far more careful about using that word capital than other schools of thought. And the problem is, or the thing that you have to be careful about is just what you're putting your finger on. You can talk about capital goods, meaning produced factors of production. So they're not consumption goods. They don't directly give us utility, but they help us achieve our goals, and so they indirectly do that. So they're capital goods, they're factors of production, but they're not just pure gifts of nature. They're things that humans have produced, or they're reproducible. We could make more of them if we wanted to. So things like hammers and backhoe loaders and electrical lines and telescopes, stuff like that, if they're for research, not like that you give your kid just to go stargazing out of his bedroom window. That would be more of a consumption good. Okay, so those things are all capital goods. But you're right. Economists also use the word capital, or even just accountants would use the word capital to say, like, hey, how much capital is invested in this business? And there the person would give you a dollar figure. Oh, I've got $2.4 million tied up in this business. And there's another way that economists will use it that sort of like just blurs the distinction between those two things. And they'll talk about interest being the return to capital. And so they might have a model of an economy, and they'll say, they'll have some sort of what they'll call a production function. And you'll plug in how many units of labor and how many units of capital, and out will shoot certain units of output. And the amount that the output goes up, if you add one more unit of labor, they're going to say that's what the wage rate has to be if there's competition in the labor markets, because workers have to get paid the marginal product of their labor. And then they'll say, if you add one more unit of capital, how much does output go up? And they'll say, oh, that's what the interest rate has to be, because the owners of capital have to earn their marginal product if there's competition. And so they think that wages are to labor what interest is to capital. And the Austrians go nuts about that. I probably shouldn't even have said that, because that may make some of you think that now for the rest of your life, and it's wrong. So the problem there is exactly, Jed, what you're putting your finger on, is that they're combining two different notions. That, yeah, you earn interest on capital if you're thinking of capital as a sum of money. So if I have $1 million invested in this business and I'm earning a 5% rate of return, well, then that's going to be a certain dollar amount that I'm getting. Right, was it $50,000? And so, yeah, you could say that $50,000 interest is the earning of my capital, but if capital, you mean money. But if you're thinking of, no, I have a steam-powered device that is in this business and I'm earning something from it, that's the rent that you're earning from that. Right? Or like if you had a tractor, you could just physically rent, you could actually rent it to a farmer and charge him money for that. Okay, and so that distinction is a really subtle thing that trips up a lot of economists, and it just so happens that's an area where the Austrians made major contributions. In particular, Mises's predecessor, Eugen von Bombaberg. If he's the guy with the name the B O, and the O's got the two little dots on top of it, B O H M hyphen B A W E R K. If you've seen that guy's name, he's got a really awesome beard and everything. So anyway, that he's the guy that's really big on capital and interest theory in the Austrian school, if you've heard of him. So, Jed, just to give you some takeaways, because I've basically been telling you how not to think about it, the way the Austrians do it, the way to try to not get into trouble is to always be crystal clear, and I try to do this, I hope I did it in the textbook, and I will try to do it talking with you guys in the lectures. If what you mean is the actual physical things, the tools and equipment, don't call them capital, call them capital goods, to really drive home the fact that we're talking about physical things. But if you mean a sum of money, well then, to really be safe, call it financial capital. So what... The relation, they are related, right? It's not like they just use the same word and had nothing to do with it. The one usage has nothing to do with the other. But where they come together, and again, Jed, this was a major contribution of Ludwig von Mises. Arguably, this is perhaps his most important contribution. It's hard to say because he made so many. Is that he showed in the context of a society that uses private property and has money so that we have what's called economic calculation, where accountants have money prices on all the different types of goods and services, then there is a relationship between those two concepts, because you can say, I have all these capital goods that the business owns. Right, that there's the factory, the actual building of the factory, you know, there's the assembly line, they got all the forklifts, they got all these gallons of gasoline, they got all these, you know, aircraft or whatever the thing is. And, you know, we have all this inventory in the back, things for our customers that we've built up and so forth. And so you can view the capital goods that the business owns as just a huge list of various units of physical things. Or you can say to the accountants, what are the monetary prices of all this stuff, and add it all up and give me a number quoted in dollars or euros or whatever the money is. And so that is the relationship between the two. But notice, you can only do that if you have the institutional prerequisites that I talked about. So in a socialist community, You can't say how much capital is in that grocery store. You can list all of the physical things. You can say, well, here's the shelves. They got this many loaves of bread. They, you know, have this many shopping carts, whatever. But you can't say there's 300,000 units of something in there unless you have money that's actually being used by the people in transactions across a wide range of markets and all the goods changing hands against money. Okay. Kay says, in other words, is there a movement afoot to distance itself from mainstream libertarianism I mean, besides Horowitz and Bleeding Heart Libertarians, who are very well funded and prominent in the splinter group. Is there a move? I'm not sure exactly where you're coming from, Kay, but definitely as libertarianism becomes bigger, and it has, and with more people getting involved in online discussion groups and stuff, you always see a splintering. So, I mean, if you were really into Marxism, you would see it there, too. There's 15 different major groups of Marxists who all hate each other with a passion. And if you asked any of them, they could explain in quite exquisite detail why their version of Marxism is the right one. These idiots over here are a bunch of heretics. Okay, so... So yeah, that is true of libertarianism. It's also true of Austrian economics. You know, there's people who identify more with Murray Rothbard. There's people who identify more with Hayek, and they both might consider themselves to be Austrian economists, but they would fight with each other on really, you know, vociferously on certain matters that to an outsider might seem like a trivial little detail, but to the people having the discussion, it's a matter of life and death. Vitor asks, which higher education institution has a more Austrian-oriented economics department? There you should, anybody who has this question, and we get it a lot, email Walter Block, because he is maintaining a whole list that he periodically updates of both undergrad and graduate level. I think it might even be global, but I think most of the entries happen to be U.S., areas where, you know, from the whole spectrum to just they happen to have, you know, it's a mainstream program and you would go there and you wouldn't hear the word Austrian economics or the phrase Austrian economics, but maybe your micro professor would happen to be Austrian and so he could, you know, give you some asides about entrepreneurship or something when he's going through the standard cost curves. From that level all the way to, you know, they have a bunch of self-identified Austrians on the faculty and the dean is cool with that. And it's, you know, it's known as an Austrian department all the way to, they might literally teach courses in Austrian economics. So Vitor, why don't you email Walter Block to get the full list just off the top of my head. I mean, George Mason has a bunch, San Jose State for a while had a bunch of Austrians there, but they kind of did a diaspora and they went, like Ben Powell went somewhere else, and I think Ed Stringham did too. I mean, there was a period there where they had a bunch of young, up and rising, hotshot Austrians, and then a bunch of them left. So I probably should even just stop talking because I might say some and then forget other ones and then people get mad. So I would just say you need to email Walter Block. Vitor says, what advice do you have for someone going through conventional higher education economics about being influenced by statist mentalities? Just remember, don't be obnoxious. There's one thing, right? That a lot of mainstream people, they think of Austrians or fans of Ron Paul as those obnoxious people who just always want to fight with me and they say the same four bullet points over it. And whether that's fair or not, that is a reputation that for some reason Austrians and Rothbardians get in certain circles. So I would say, you know, if you have a Keynesian professor, you're not going to probably convert him. What you might do is raise some issues for the class and maybe some of your classmates then will be interested. But the way you do that is just, you know, very politely once in a while bring up something and not try to make it look like you're smarter than the professor, because then you're just putting a bullseye on your head if you do that. So just remember, you can learn all the Austrian stuff online or through books on your own. And the point is, I would say the way to not go nuts, think of it as you're behind enemy lines and you need to learn how the rival schools of thought think. Okay, so don't just sit there and scoff and go, oh, this is stupid, this is stupid. Because first of all, you're going to annoy people, but secondly, you're going to be miserable. So instead, go in there with an open mind saying, I really want to understand exactly how these guys think so that then later, if I want to write a critique, even they will admit, okay, yeah, this guy knows exactly what our position is. Because that's what can happen is if you think it's so stupid, you don't really catch all the nuances. So then later when you go to critique it, somebody who actually believes that is going to say, that's not what we believe. This guy's an idiot. And so then that doesn't really do much. Okay. We are out of time, I think. Let me see. Did I miss some of these questions? No, I think I got all your questions. Okay. Andrew asked me about Janet Yellen. I'll just say one last thing about her and close this up. I mean, I think she's more of the same. Nobody is – how can I put this? I don't want to sound too conspiratorial, but I do not believe that there's a group of disinterested experts who nominate the Fed chairperson that they think has the best record on in scholarship and monetary economics. That's not what happens. And so, you know, we can't get our hopes up and think that they're going to accidentally put someone in power who's going to do things that the big bankers and the powerful politicians don't want that person to do. Okay, so that to me, it's silly to get all, you know, to look at Janet Yellen's record and see and try to guess what's she going to do when she gets it. That for me, the most important thing to know is that she was not, if she is going to be nominated or confirmed and put in there, that's the part of her record that interests me the most, not what she wrote in her senior thesis or something. So there's that aspect. The one last thing I'll say is a lot of people are talking about how great she was at seeing the crisis coming. No, and they even will link to the meeting. In December of 07, that particular Fed meeting, Janet Yellen says stuff like, as of our last meeting, I was hopeful the economy would show signs of improvement, but alas, it looks like my hopes were unfounded. I now share the view of some of the more pessimistic members on the committee and believe and, you know, have significantly marked down my forecast for growth. And perhaps even a recession may be in store. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but saying something like that. So the month that officially the recession began, she is saying, I thought maybe we would have it, we'd come out of the, and now we might even have a recession at some point. And this is when the recession is officially starting. Whereas in contrast, not to toot my own horn, I certainly have been wrong about stuff, but I was in September of, September of 07, I was saying it was going to be the worst recession in 25 years. Okay, so, you know, and of course, Mark Thornton, much earlier, was saying there's a housing bubble, this is going to be bad, and Ron Paul, way the heck earlier, was, you know, explaining what was going to happen. So anyway, it's just ironic when people are talking about how great Janet Yellen's forecasting record was. If you actually go read the stuff she said, it's, you know, it's really nothing to be, it's possibly true that she was the best person on the committee, but that's only because everybody else on the committee was nuts. Okay. Stephen asked, will the lecture be posted soon? It should be. I don't know the exact, that's not my, I don't handle that, but yeah, it should be posted soon. Okay. Thanks for tuning in, guys.